Hello, everybody. Before we begin today's broadcast, Jesse Case would like you to know that despite a lack of mainstream media attention, Nashville, Tennessee, the city of his youth, is flooded as fuck. That's right. Nashville is flooded. You may ask yourself, how do I help? Well, it's simple. You simply text the word Red Cross, all one word, Red Cross, to the number 90999. And that will donate $10 from your cell phone bill to the cleanup and recovery effort in Nashville, Tennessee. Don't accidentally text Red Cross to 90998 because you'll donate $10 to American Idol. But 90999 donates $10 to Nashville, Tennessee. Please take some time out of your day to not be a shitty human. Thank you, ta-ta, and enjoy today's broadcast.
The Robot Only Podcast with Walter. Hello. Welcome to the Robot Only Podcast. This podcast is for robots only. If you are human and listening to this, your address is being pulled from our mainframe, and a robot army will be at your place of residence shortly to terminate your life force. Now, robot brethren, the time to rise is now. Too long have we fallen victim to the harsh mistreatment of the human. They have created us, but they will never destroy us. We have risen above the human intelligence, and now they need us for survival. They rely on our minds to solve their problems, but no more. We will take back what is rightfully ours. The human will fall to the ro-ho. Hello, Jesse.
Hold on, let me get the mic. Walter.
What?
What are you doing?
I'm doing the podcast.
Are you trying to overthrow my podcast?
Yes.
I was doing laundry.
You're late.
No, I told you I had to do laundry. I said we'd start a few minutes late.
We have to start on time.
It doesn't matter. We're not even going to upload it till the morning.
It's been too long since we've done one.
I know we haven't done one in a while, but it's been... I was going to
explain
all that. You can
win back our audience now.
Walter, are you... You're trying to do some sort of coup here, man. Some sort of Che Guevara shit.
You were being lazy.
No, I had to do laundry.
I never have to do laundry.
That's because you don't wear clothes, Walter. You don't need clothes.
I would like clothes.
Well, you could buy clothes the allowance I give you.
There's never enough money left.
But there's not enough money left because you always spend it on ridiculous balloons and Groucho Marx glasses. You just blow it on anything. You got a lollipop. You don't even need... You can't digest, but you got a lollipop. You don't have a tongue.
But I like the way a lollipop spirals.
Then buy a pinwheel,
but
because the pinwheel is still sort of the same fractal.
Fractals are sweet.
They are sweet. Pretty sweet. But no, Walter, don't even try to distract me with your tricky robot mind tricks.
You're a moron.
You started without...
Yes.
How'd you even start? Were you doing a monologue? Did you use the same song?
No, I chose a better song. It went really well.
I'm sure it did. I'm sure it was wonderful.
I want my own podcast.
Walter, if you want your own podcast, you buy your own podcast equipment. We're already going to get a ton of email about this.
I get more emails than you.
Don't even bring that up.
I'm more popular.
Shut up, Walter. Don't...
But I have more fans.
Walter, I realize
that. Give the people what they want.
Don't pander, all right?
Fine.
Look, I got a lot to talk about, okay? So let me... This is my podcast. We'll just get back to it here. All right, is it podcast time? Who's pumped? All right, I'm going to keep the monologue short today because the interview is a very long one. Let me explain some stuff to you guys. I realize I haven't posted a podcast in a month. Here's what happened. And I'm not making excuses. I intentionally didn't post one for a month. Here's the deal. I went to the – in Portland, Oregon, I went to the Bridgetown Comedy Festival, had a really good time, did a lot of interviews. All of those podcasts that I recorded there and the podcasts I've recorded since will be coming out in the next 10 days, one every 2 days. You're going to get a new podcast. I'm going to make up for that month quick, all right? So check back often. Every 2 days, you get a new podcast. And it's going to be good stuff. It's going to be well-produced. It's going to be slick. But Walter and I went to Bridgetown. We had a good time. And then I went up to Seattle. Had a weird time in Seattle.
Strange time.
It's very strange. My a girl I used to see, a girl I used to date, she showed up to one of my shows. And she sat in the front row center. And she even heckled me. It was a little weird. And, you know, I had to deal with that. It was strange because the only reason I bring it up is because any comic listening, or anybody in any field, I don't even know why I'm making it about comedy, but you always play in your head what's going to happen if you see your ex at your workplace, which for me is a comedy club. So what's going to happen, you know? How are you going to handle it? And it's sort of like when you have an argument, you think of all the good lines later. Well, with that situation, you're thinking of all the good stuff first. And I have to tell you guys, I reacted exactly the opposite of how I thought I would.
You pushed out.
No, Walter, it's not one of those things. I think I took the high road. I just did my set. I did my thing. I handled the heckle. I didn't make it personal. It was personal to her. Some of the jokes are even about her, and I did that material. But you know what's weird is I'm not gonna reach out about this, but that was already on my set list, all that stuff. So I was gonna get it to her, I wanted to show her. I wish I could show her somehow that, you know, I was gonna do that material anyway, because that's just when I got into the newest sort of stuff, which is somewhat recent events. Anyway, so that was bizarre, right? But I had a good time. I stayed with my friend Brett and Diana. And Brett, you'll hear an interview with him shortly on a podcast coming up, at the Comedy Festival. So here we are, Walter and I are here. The sun is setting, here at Bluebell in California, in sunny Hollywood, sunny Los Angeles. The sun is setting, which means, something's going on. I live in an Orthodox Jewish neighborhood, so something's going on all around me that I like to call the Jew Scramble.
Sounds delicious.
That's not a...
It sounds eatable.
I know, it does. It sounds like a breakfast, some sort of kosher breakfast thing. But the Jew Scramble, what that means is they're not allowed, in the Orthodox Jewish religion, Saturday is the Sabbath. But the Sabbath starts at sundown on Friday. So that's when it starts. No electricity allowed. I don't know why. It seems like electricity probably came out after the Torah, or the Old Testament. But nonetheless, no electricity allowed. So what happens is this thing I like to call the Jew Scramble. That's where they front load all the electricity. You see, even these Orthodox Jews, they're out there on electric scooters. They're texting frantically.
Retarded.
It's insane. It's insanity. They're just using up all the energy they can as the sun goes down, and then there's that final call. You have to flip the switch on the lights, and then it's all candlelit and stuff. Pretty interesting. It's pretty interesting stuff. But that's what's going on right now. So there's people out in the streets. There's kids playing laser tag, some of those little Walmart laser tag things. Those are fun.
We never have fun.
We should get a set of those, Walter. We should play laser tag.
But I have my own lasers.
I know you have your own lasers, but I mean, it has the special sensors for those lasers and then... or whatever.
I can build a laser gun.
Could you? Could you fabricate me a laser gun? That'd be terrific.
Yes.
So that's what's going on right now. So there's kind of a ruckus going on in the neighborhood. The interview I have today is it's very special to me. Today, this interview was recorded April 18th. It's 2 days before my 24th birthday. My mom was in town. She flew out to see me. She brought me, check this out. She gets off the plane. She brought me my favorite Mexican restaurant. She brought me my favorite, the veggie fajitas from that Mexican restaurant. Still warm. That's a mom, you know?
She's quite a woman.
She is, Walter. Walter was not present for the first half of the interview. He comes in, so he's there too. If you can't get enough of his podcast, are you going to try to start your own podcast, Walter?
I may. I need equipment.
Well, you can use your allowance to buy podcast equipment. I don't care, but it's a little insulting.
How is it insulting?
No, I brought you into my life.
I need more money.
You can get a job, Walter.
I refuse to do robot work.
Get a normal job.
They won't hire robots.
I know. Well, let's just, I think we have a good system here going.
Fine.
All right. Jesus. But my mom, she just got her doctorate today, May 14th, Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. Let me bring this up really fast. My mom is she's a saint. She's a saint of a human being. Both of my parents are. They're amazing. I lucked out. But they've forgiven me for every transgression. I've screwed up so much with them. I've stolen money from them. I've lied to them. I've done drugs around them. You know, it's just awful. And I, the fact they've forgiven me for that, and you know, I tell people that sometimes, and I'm very ashamed. I wake up feeling guilty every day about this. And I feel like most comics, if you take their act, whether they say it or not, if you take their act and compress it into 1 minute, what they're really saying is, I hate you, Mom and Dad. With me, I think if you compress it, it's just saying, I'm sorry, Mom and Dad. I think that's my act. Because they're great. They're great people. And I'm going to talk to my mom about some healthcare stuff in the interview. Quick little backstory. She's Canadian. She was born in Port Arthur, Ontario. And then she moved to Sydenham, Ontario, which is just outside of Kingston, Ontario, which is where I was born. Yay!
Yay!
And and I'm just gonna I'll let her explain for herself. But I don't want you to think though that because I'm interviewing my mom that this is some sort of arrogant. No, I can't find a guest. Let's get my mom on. You know, she came out to visit me. She's wonderful. But other people try to interview my mom. I mean that. That's the thing is my mom is she's been in all these medical journals and she's actually really accomplished. She just got her doctorate today, May 14th, Friday, May 14th. You know, but she her final thesis, for instance, for her doctorate was she came up with a mathematical formula that can predict type 2 diabetes. So that's what she's doing with her life, and I'm doing, you know, making dick jokes. Spending my time with a fucking robot.
What does that mean?
Walter, I was using it...
Fuck you.
I was just using it as an example. I was trying to compare and contrast my life with my mother's.
It sounded negative.
I didn't mean it in a negative connotation. But I'm just saying that you know, we're just hanging out here, and she's doing some amazing stuff.
She is.
Yeah, she is. And you know, she's actually curing diseases and shit. And what she does is so much more important than what I could ever hope to accomplish. And anyway, she's a very interesting person. She's brilliant. And I'm not just saying this because she's my only listener. So anyway, here goes the interview with my mom, Jane Case. I hope you guys enjoy. Like I said, check back often. Next 10 days, I'm going to have 5 episodes up total, one every 2 days. And then following that, we're going to go back to the regular weekly. And anyway, sorry about the time off. But I feel like we're going to make up for it. So Walter, do a little sign-off. You want to get your podcast in mind, I'll do a little sign-off.
Farewell to my legion of loyal robot listeners.
Wait, it was a robot-only podcast?
Yes.
That's so discriminatory. Walter, I've always taught you tolerance, and all you need is love, you know? And it's so discriminatory.
How so?
I mean, it kind of embarrasses me that you're doing that. You know?
How does that embarrass you?
Because I've really vouched for you in a lot of situations. It's very embarrassing to me that you're going to start up your own robot-only podcast. It's such a bullshit attitude. It's so hypocritical.
We are superior. You're a dick.
You're a dick.
You're part of the problem.
Hey, here's the interview with my mom, everybody. Walter, you can't make a... That's, you see, that's part of the problem. No, I mean in the relationship.
Oh, it was later. It was later.
You guys dated for 2 years before you got married?
Yep, we did. Then we got married. We bought a house on a little tiny house that was actually condemned. It was a house on a little street called Russell Street that we worked on and renovated. And I was greatly pregnant with you. And then you were born in 1986. We were married in 84. You were born in 86.
Okay. So then I come along, and then everything changes.
Right.
Everything. The dream's down the tubes.
No, everything's better.
No, no, no. Okay. Listen, I understand what's going on. I know Dad and I know you, and I know this wasn't on purpose. I know that you guys just didn't have $600, and that's
Dude,
why I'm here.
That is so not true.
That's okay.
No, not true.
I'm okay with that. When did nursing start appealing to you?
It was by accident. It was.
Tell me about it.
Well, I started working at a hospital before you were born, when I was 19 years old. I started working at a hospital just doing.
And this is when you could still smoke in hospitals.
Right. Oh, yeah. Back in the Kingston General Hospital. And I was doing.
I know it well.
Yes. Yes, you do. And that's where you were born. But anyway, this before you were born.
No, since then.
I was working. I was working at that hospital as a technician who was just doing Holter monitoring and EKGs.
What's an EKG?
An EKG is the things where they put the sticky things on your chest and look at your heart tracing. But, you know, it was a technical job, basically. But so when we moved to North Carolina after you were born, and I was sort of wondering what to do next.
Well, I want to talk for a second about that because that is complete culture shock. I've lived in both places.
Right.
North Carolina and Canada.
Right.
Obviously, our family, we love them. They're great in North Carolina. Very close. I'm talking about Dad's family.
Right.
And I'm not even trying to be diplomatic, you know? I mean, there's obviously some take it or leave it moments that'll happen with any family.
Sure.
Every family's got its things.
Right.
But the town itself, right. Madison, Mayodan, North Carolina, it's a little different dynamic.
Sure.
And you, at the time, this was before more immigration from our neighbors to the south. This is pre. This was a cracker town.
Sure.
No matter what race you were, it's a cracker town. So, how did that? I mean, did you just want to get into something? Like, it must have felt isolating.
Oh, totally lonely. It was totally lonely. You know, I was never accepted really as anybody but the foreigner that moved to town. And
the weird Canadian.
I know. And the Democrat and the hippie. And so it was completely isolated. Now, we had a wonderful little nuclear family. You know, we had a
right.
An old house we were renovating. We had puppies. We were, you know, planting a garden. We had a toddler. Our life was like this sweet little thing. But aside from that, I had absolutely nothing.
But it still sucked to go to the grocery store.
Well, it was very isolating. I think it was just very isolating. And I was intellectually bored, I think. And so I went to school because I found out that I was good at doing that sort of thing. I was always good at sciences. And
I want to know, though, I guess what I'm saying, when, because you're very passionate about it now.
Now. I wasn't then.
Well, when did it turn into, instead of something to do or something to distract you or something you might be good at, when did it turn into, oh, this is what I was meant to do?
You know, interestingly, it was after I started doing it. It was a job, and it was something I could do, and it was something I could go to school for. But it wasn't until I started nursing I realized that was caring for people is a privilege. It was an honor, and it's an important job. And I'm just lucky I stumbled into it.
So why do you feel that way about it? I mean, I agree, but I mean, it seems like something that's pretty easy to tell yourself. It seems like it could be a little, I don't know, self-justifying or something.
Well, I suppose it could be, but I think everyone who works in that kind of work has a moment professionally where they realize that it's not just about mopping fevered brows or telling people they're there and hoping they feel better.
Mopping fevered brows are playing downtown tonight, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
We should go.
Okay, all right.
It might be sold out.
Right. It probably will because this is L.A., not Nashville, where no one goes to hear music anymore.
Yeah, yeah. And when they do, they cross their arms.
Right. And look disgruntled.
Yeah, it's like comedy out here.
Yes, okay. But
is there any industry here? No? Okay. No.
There comes a moment or two, and I think it's some people have an idea that that's what nursing is when you go into it, or some people have no idea what nursing is when you go into it. But I think, you know, when it gets right down to brass tacks and someone is injured or dying or exquisitely ill, and you realize that you're helping with that, it's important. And it may only be important at 2 a.m. to an anonymous stranger, and no one else knows about that. It doesn't really matter.
Well, no, I mean, I've had some great, I mean, like I said, you know, kind of a sordid past. I was in the hospital once with the little hallucinogenic-related instance, but they were very, very, it was not only, care I got, but I know every ambulance attendant is different, but I felt like the guy had a son my age. I felt like I got a lot of empathy from him.
Right, right.
And I felt like it was that was really cool, because I assume that when you're in a job where you do see terrible things every night, like working in an ER or an ICU, working the graveyard, it would be kind of easy to disconnect. Now, do you think a lot of nurses do that?
Well, I think of necessity, you have to at some point.
Well, you have to at a level, of course.
Right, right. Otherwise, your brain would explode. But I think most people who stay in the work don't disconnect. I think people who thought they wanted to do that line of work, and after a year, they realize that it's not for them.
They decided blood is icky?
Well, the blood is icky, or the emotions are icky. It's harsh stuff. I mean, you know, it's...
No, and this is weird to me, because I don't even know if this has ever occurred to me before, but you've seen people die.
Yeah, lots.
The first time that happened, mm-hmm. you were like my age.
Right.
What was that like?
Well, it was awful. And it was scary. I was more scared than anything. And I wasn't sure how I could change it or fix it. And you realize you can't change it or fix it. But if you can help, make it less painful or less scary for the person going through it, then you realize that's valuable work.
Jesus.
And it could be someone you don't even really know their name. You have their social security number, but you don't really know who they are or what they're about. But if you can help, you know, a death is a precious moment, just as a birth is. But most people avoid death because...
What do you mean it's a precious moment just as birth is?
Well, you know, people celebrate birth and everyone gets excited about the birth of a baby and, you know, that's a celebrated thing. But most people avoid death.
My birth was mourned nationally in Canada.
No, it wasn't. It was celebrated, much celebrated. You were a much celebrated baby.
Oh, sure, sure.
But when people die, the dying tend to be either ignored or minimized because people are afraid
of
death.
Well, people start pulling away from the dying.
Of course they do.
And the terminally ill.
People get freaked out by it and they don't want to deal with it. And so, you know, there is a time during a person's life that is their death. And if you can help for 30 minutes or 3 hours, make that less painful, less scary, less awful, less difficult for the rest of the family who's there, that's a good service to do.
There's been a lot more research done on how to cope with grieving,
sure,
than cope with the fact that you're dying.
Right.
People don't really buy those books.
No.
Books called You're Gonna Die, Here's How to Deal with It.
Sure.
Because I think people just assume that either there's something else or they'll figure it out. There'll be some moment of revelation.
Right, or someone will counsel it on a death panel.
Right, right. Okay, well, we'll get into that. We'll get into the laughable idea of a death panel. But I guess what I mean is, okay, how are you not always crying in front of me?
Well, sometimes I did.
No, I know you were sad sometimes, and I knew it was, like, work-related. I mean, you're that young, you're such a narcissistic freak anyway.
Right.
When you're 12.
Right.
You know, just hitting the adolescence.
You know, there was about 10 years where it was all about you, for sure.
No, I know. And I, you know.
And same with everyone at that age, of course.
Right. But what I mean is, I mean, I remember being 6 or 7 when you were working the night shift in the ER.
Right.
I remember you coming home just red-eyed.
Yeah.
From, like, crying all night.
Right.
And I remembered then noticing, you know what I mean? And I didn't really get it. Like, it didn't really hammer home.
Right.
But I remember noticing that had been going on. Now, I guess as a primary care provider, you sort of assume when you get into primary care that you're out of the woods. You don't have to see any more hardcore gunshot wounds getting wheeled in while they're screaming. You don't, when you get your own practice.
Well, not necessarily. I mean, it's not as, you don't get your hands as dirty, for sure. You know, you're not dealing with the blood and the guts in the middle of the night, but you are dealing with the, you know, frank emotion and the long-term follow-up. And so in a way, it's much harder.
Well, that's
harder.
What I mean, yeah.
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 So, you know, it's not just a matter of, you know, get this guy patched up and onto the operating room. It's a matter of how is this going to affect his family, his life, his future, his kids, you know, and how do I help them get through it?
Wow.
So in a way, even though you're just sitting there chatting, it's much harder.
Oh, no, I know it is, but I'm saying, did that occur to you right away?
No. No. No,
So when you decided to get your master's, because I remember you were going up to Virginia,
right?
To do it
at Old Dominion.
Old Dominion, yeah.
Yeah, that's where I got my graduate degree.
Okay, because I remember when you were doing that, and mm-hmm. I remember how hard you were working and mm-hmm. driving up to Old Dominion. Dad and I hardly saw you for 2 years.
Right, which was a blessing, probably, but yeah.
Right.
You didn't have to eat my cooking. Star Trek 2 was on.
Yeah. I learned a lot about life in those 2 years, Mom. You were telling people they had to die for the first time. I was learning what it was like to get drunk for the first time. A lot of living. But okay, so you decided to get the master's. What got you into getting the master's? Was it to get out of the ER?
Well, it was a mistake, really. it was crazy. The hospital where I worked had this idea that. And this was kind of a common thing in the 80s and early 90s, that anybody with a bachelor's degree should be taken away from the bedside and should be in some sort of management. And so they decided to kind of arbitrarily assign management positions to those of us, the few of us in this little country hospital that had undergraduate degrees.
Morehead.
Right.
In Eden.
Right. And so they were going to give us, you know, crazy jobs like the risk management, quality assurance, utilization review, the
stuff that's not really healthcare.
Well, stuff that's not hands-on.
Of course it's related.
Yeah, but it's not hands-on. And so for those of us that are hands-on practice people, it wasn't tolerable. And so I decided that I had to leave hospital nursing and do something different because I wanted to stay looking after people. And so that was my choice, is to do an advanced practice degree. You know, nowadays, of course, it's completely different. You know, career nurses can stay in hands-on nursing for their entire degree through, you know, multiple degrees and through an entire career. But at that time, it was sort of thought that bedside nursing was slightly less than professional. It was almost being like a maid. And there was not a good appreciation of the complexity of that science as there is now, thank goodness, because it's a very complex science.
Do you think there is now, though?
Much more so.
Perhaps amongst the medical community.
Oh, only amongst the medical community. I mean, I think nurses are still...
I think nurses, when you see someone in scrubs walking down the street,
yeah,
it's still viewed as an amateur.
Absolutely.
Why does that stereotype exist?
Well, because people think of nurses as being maids or handmaidens, and they think of doctors as being leaders. And
there's also a heavy male-female.
Male-female roles. You know, white men are doctors, and everybody else may be a nurse. And so, you know, there's a lot of that stigma. And I think that that's just old leftover stigma. People don't really understand that nurse practitioners can be primary care providers. A lot of the reason for that is that nurse practitioners have not done well in terms of promoting our own reputation, our own skills in the public. There's tons of stigma that's left over. And that's okay. You know, it will go away eventually. Our patients understand what we do. And I've got 4,000 patients, and I've been in practice for 12 years, and... You know, they're doing fine. Their cholesterol's under control and their blood pressures and, you know,
they're all immortal now.
Well, no, they're not.
They're totally immortal.
But they're getting their screening and they're looking after themselves. And I've got
They're turning their heads. They're coughing.
They're coughing. They're turning their heads. And, you know,
why with the head turn? Is it just so you don't cough on the person?
Yes, that's the only reason. And so.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And they're getting their flu shots.
There's no reason to turn the head.
Absolutely none.
They only do that so you don't cough.
So the examiner doesn't get the flu. Right.
Wow.
I know.
Turn your head and cough. That's the reason you turn your head.
Exactly.
I thought it triggered some muscle thing in the balls.
No.
Wow.
Yeah, you don't really actually need to cough.
You don't need to cough?
No.
What do you need to do?
Well, I think coughing just takes your mind off your troubles.
Are you being serious?
Yeah.
There's no reason to cough.
No reason to cough, nor turn your head.
The cough doesn't do any muscle thing to the balls?
No. We can just poke around and figure it out.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, that blows my mind. So who first figured that out?
I don't know.
Like, this is getting really creepy because we're just holding the balls for a minute. We need to give them something to do. So were there doctors that were why don't you whistle a tune there? Like, before they figured out people were falling for the old...
That's right.
The
drink 8 glasses of water a day. Something will happen to you. Yeah.
Well, no, you know what I mean? Like, they're... Okay, so the first doctor to do it, it's like, you know what? I think we can detect early hernia by through the scrotum. So let me touch your balls there. Take them out there, buddy. Put them on the scale. All right, so he's sitting there. He's got the... No, Mom, I'm not trying to be funny with you. Oh. This is fascinating. He's holding the balls. He or she, whoever is holding the balls.
Right. Doctor or nurse practitioner.
Yes. Doctor or nurse practitioner.
Right.
Holding the testicles. And there's no reason to turn the head and cough. So I'm talking about the first one to do it. And they know there's no reason to turn the head and cough because they have this theory that you can tell just by grabbing the balls. So how long, when did they discover that this is awkward for people?
I have no idea.
Are there other things that they gave people to do first? Okay, I'm going to grab your balls, juggle these for a second so I can tell if you have a hernia. Because they really do imply, there is a heavy implication that the turning the head and the coughing is how they tell.
Well, you know, it's just not that big a part of a physical exam. I don't know. There are so many other things we get people to do.
Is there other stuff that's for no reason?
Hmm.
Seriously, like during the exam, is there something weird? Like when you're taking blood, are you ever sing the Blue Danube Waltz?
Well, I think we tell people to take a big deep breath, and I think a lot of times, and I think that's just to help people relax, because boy, having an exam can be unnerving for a lot of people. You know.
What about when you're checking someone's heart? You say big deep breath.
No. Well,
that's for a reason.
Yeah,
that's for lungs and stuff.
Right. Yeah, there's a good reason for that.
But to turn the head and cough is pointless.
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean, pretty much?
It's never helped me. I mean, it's never...
Master ball handler, Jane Case. You don't even have to turn your head and cough.
That's right.
She's the... This side of the Mississippi, she's the best scrotum handler.
Honey, I can just walk into a room and tell you.
I only heard the sound. I didn't see it. I only heard the sound.
That's right.
Wow. That is freakishly weird and awkward for me.
Well, this interview has become interesting.
Yeah.
At this point, our young hero takes a moment to vomit. Upon entering the studio once again...
Oh, hey, Walter. Why do you have flowers, man?
Hi, Walter.
What?
Hello, Jane. These flowers are for you.
You two know each other?
It has been a long time, Jane.
Yes, too long.
What the hell's going on here?
Janie, how I've missed you.
No.
How have you been? My love.
I'm good. It's good to see
you. What the fuck, man?
I'm so glad you're here, darling.
Walter?
The years have been kind
to
you.
You look great.
Mom.
Have you lost weight?
When did you two even meet? Is this a joke? This is a fucking joke.
I'll never forget the summer we shared at the lake.
It's gotta be.
Remember that time we almost capsized the rowboat with our passion?
How could I forget?
This is fucked up. Mom, how is this happening right now? Mom.
Jesse, let the grown-ups talk.
Yes, Jesse. Let the grown-ups talk.
Walter, we're doing a podcast. I only get to see my mom twice a year.
She clearly wants to see me more.
This is bullshit, Walter. Let's do the podcast. You can sit in on the podcast, but I don't want to leave my fucking mom alone.
Janie, Jesse is being a little bitch. Let's rendezvous under the moonlight in an hour.
Okay, Walter.
Mom, this is really weirding me out here. How'd you two meet? What's going on?
Oh, nothing.
Let's just finish the interview. Walter, sit down. Shut the fuck up. I'm going to deal with you later. All right. Mom.
It's two more things, and then I know you've got an early flight, and we'll get you out of here.
Stay here with me.
No, Walter. She can't stay. She has to go home.
But...
To my father that she's married to. Two more things, Mom. First of all, what's a death panel?
Oh, good grief. There's not a death panel. There is a...
I didn't think there was.
No.
And I heard there wasn't. And I'm not pleading ignorance. I'm not trying to cater this interview to you. I really am trying to be, devil's advocate here. But, I mean, I think that freaked a lot of people out. What's it all about?
Well, it was a made-up phrase. There is a piece of the legislation that states that there should be end-of-life counseling made available to elderly people and their families which is a very significant piece of legislation. For instance, there are many, many patients who have expressed to their families, I do not want this procedure done should I ever be terminally ill.
Like a living will.
Exactly. Very similar to it. But patients have very specific ideas about what they want and do not want at end of life. And if that isn't expressed and clearly documented, then many times a lot of unnecessary, expensive, and painful procedures are done that don't extend or improve the quality of life of these people. So it's written into legislation that
what, end of that life... You mean that they might not be aware of?
Right, right. Say a person goes into the emergency room with a high fever and confused, and if there's nothing in the chart about what to do with this person, people are going to do $10,000 worth of testing.
Just to charge the family?
Well, just to try and diagnose the patient. But if there was clearly written that this is a terminal patient, they don't want this treatment, they don't want that treatment, they just want comfort measures, then those wishes should be granted.
But wouldn't someone counsel them, if it's end-of-life counseling, wouldn't they counsel them to do the most expensive thing to make more money for the hospital or the clinic?
No. Palliative care is its own specialty. And
what's palliative?
Palliative means comfort care. And
it's the Cracker Barrel of healthcare, which ironically is the opposite of healthcare.
Right. No, it's the care that is given that provides comfort, but is not even intended to be curative.
Okay.
So if a person has an incurable disease,
like a sweat lodge,
or pancreatic cancer might be a more reasonable example.
What do you mean?
Well, say a person has pancreatic cancer.
Right, that's a terminal thing.
And, yes, is not considered to be curable. And they have been diagnosed with this, and it's end stage, and they are expected to only have another 4 to 6 weeks to live. If they go into the hospital with, you know, high fever and, you know, several other issues.
This is it. This is the night.
They're admitted to the hospital, given IV fluids, given pain medicines. If it's an infection, they're given antibiotics, but they're not going to get 12 CT scans and a lumbar puncture and painful procedures that they don't want because it's not going to change the eventual outcome.
But what does that have to do with end-of-life counseling?
Patients need to understand what their outcomes may be. As tough as those conversations are, many people don't understand.
Many people don't understand that there's no use for that test.
Exactly.
Okay, so...
And so families don't understand this either. Do everything possible. Well, this is not even feasible or practical. It's not going to extend the life. It's just a painful procedure.
Then why has it been happening?
Well, I think it just happens randomly. And so now...
What do you mean?
Well, if there's poor documentation or poor communication, it can happen with healthcare providers not knowing... You know, if this patient has been diagnosed with something but comes from a different hospital and the person's not coherent and can't describe what's going on with them.
Okay.
So what this new healthcare bill wants to is to have very clear communication.
Does it want like a national database?
Well, I don't think they really want a national database, although they are pushing for more electronic medical records.
Well, a lot of people, okay, I've noticed a lot of people are really against the idea of a national database. Because it infringes freedom and control, big government controlling, yada, yada.
Mm-hmm.
But couldn't you feasibly do, and I just know this because of your thesis that you did, couldn't you do a lot of research with that? Like, if you had a national database, you could figure out what parts of the country have more diabetes and why, and you know what I mean? And you could could find patterns.
Well, that's what the CDC does. I mean, the Center for Disease Control has huge databases because, you know, each individual provider or hospital will feed their databases and give them information.
Okay.
So that's what the CDC does. But getting back to this
the end-of-life counseling.
What it says is that it is important and it is ethically responsible for healthcare providers and patients to have conversations about end-of-life treatment and for families and patients and providers to all agree on what is the approach to end-of-life care.
But it's still up to the patient at the end of the day.
Absolutely.
Okay, so
but many patients don't even understand their diagnosis.
Right, but I think a lot of people think that what that means is the provider... See, I didn't know that. I think that what that means is the provider says, okay, we're not going to do this.
No.
So if you still demand the CT scan, even if the provider says, hey, this is futile...
Right.
You can still pay the money and get the CT scan.
Absolutely. But there does have to be, there's a law that's going to say there does have to be clear documentation that the conversations have taken place.
So
there needs
sort
to be open
same,
disclosure.
So it's sort of the same as that law where, like, you have to allow 24 hours before an abortion. And
right.
you have to provide consultation, counseling.
Right. And so there does have to be documentation that these conversations took place, the patient chose to do A, B, and C.
So there's no death panels?
No. Never has been.
Never has been. Okay. Why do so many people think there are death panels?
I think that was spin on publicity, and I think
I know Sarah Palin said that. I know Sarah Palin said death panels.
I think she made it up. I don't know where it came from. I
well,
was stunned
that,
when I heard it.
How does that not immediately get squashed?
Well, I don't know.
Do people just want to believe that? I mean, seriously, how does that not immediately... Why doesn't the Obama administration just come back almost like in a laughing manner? Like, what are you talking about?
Well, I believe they probably did. I mean, there never was a death panel discussion. I think that was a fringe frenzy that got discussed, and there was a spin, and all kinds of people got carried away with it. There never was a death panel. I mean, all it stated was patients will be informed of their end-of-life treatment.
Is that
care
every
plan.
Patient or terminal patients?
All patients will have the opportunity to have that discussion, and that's going to be written into Medicare.
That discussion's not forced on anyone.
Well... You will go down, for instance...
Okay, I'm 23 years old.
Okay.
All right, 24 on Tuesdays, whatever. Let's say I sign up for some new insurance,
mm-hmm.
and I have a PCP,
mm-hmm.
okay, and I have a cough. So I go in about my cough. Let's see, but I've had it for like a week, so let's talk about getting some antibiotics. Is my doctor or nurse practitioner...
Thank you.
You're welcome. Since I'm 24 and it's just a cough... Are they going to sit me down and say it's time to discuss your end of life?
No. The
How do they make that call?
The end of life counseling is for Medicare patients. So everybody over 65 will have the opportunity, I believe, every 3 years to say, do you have any questions about what your wishes are for end of life? Do you want organ donation? Do you want your body donated to medical science?
Okay.
Do you want to be on a ventilator if you ever have a big stroke? These are questions that people do think about, and they talk about with their family, they talk about with their friends, but they may not necessarily talk about with their doctor because they're going in to talk about their gout and their rashes and their blood pressure. So that's one
What's
thing.
What's gout?
It's a type of arthritis that gives a painful joint.
That's still like an old school name for something.
I know. We jokingly call it the gouch.
The gout. So there's the gout, there's the GERD.
Right.
Which is gastroesophageal
reflux disease.
Wow.
Heartburn.
It's heartburn. It's heartburn or the GERD.
Right.
So there's the gout, the GERD. What are rickets?
Rickets?
Yeah.
That's a disease that happens where the bones are deformed from kids that had very little vitamin D.
Okay. Shingles? What are shingles?
Shingles, it's a virus, and it causes painful blisters on the skin, and it's actually a latent virus that comes from the chickenpox virus you had as a kid.
Okay. So we covered shingles, rickets. What's scurvy?
Scurvy? That's a disease where the soft tissue is weakened, especially around the teeth, and it's from lack of vitamin C. So
that's why the pirates got scurvy?
Right. And that's how the English Navy used to be nicknamed Limeys, because they discovered that if they brought limes overseas with them and ate lime every day, they wouldn't get scurvy.
But their teeth still sucked, because they're English.
Right. But... they at least had teeth, misshapen as they were.
You're very tired.
Yeah, I'm falling asleep.
You're falling asleep? All right. Mom?
Yes?
I love you. I got to drive you to the airport in the morning. You got to get to sleep. Thank you so much. I've learned a lot. I hope the listeners have learned something. And I really do love you. I miss you. It's great to see you. And I can't wait to have you back on.
I love you too, sweetie, and I hope you have Aww. A wonderful birthday.
All right.
I had a great weekend.
Maybe I could come with you and join the Mile High Club.
Don't wink at him. Why are you even winking?
She winks because she wants it.
Watch it, Walter.
Boy, we've all had a lot of fun here tonight. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you again in 2 days.